Good afternoon. Good afternoon. We're going to get started. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you being here at the opening of our spring exhibition, which is sponsored by the partners of the UCI Libraries. I'm Jerry Munoff, University Librarian. Before I introduce our speaker, I wanted to just share with you some recent news about the libraries. We're almost at the midpoint of spring quarter, so we're thinking about the end of the academic year. It's been a very busy year for us. Certainly the economy and the state budget situation has captured our attention this year in many respects, but we've continued to focus in the libraries on our primary mission, which is building excellent collections and services for students and faculty to facilitate and support their excellent research and instruction. The continuing growth of the campus has placed tremendous demands on the libraries, and while there's considerable growth in the online use of libraries' resources and services, we continue to set records for the in-person use of our library buildings also. So we're having to deal with both the online environment and the more traditional environment. To keep up with the demand, we continue to renovate and to improve our facilities, primarily to handle more numbers of students. A few projects we have just completed and are going to be undertaking I wanted to mention to you. One is the Gateway Study Center, which is across the plaza here, the library's Gateway Study Center. That was renovated and opened this fall. That was one of the original buildings on campus from the 60s. It had never been touched since that time. So the renovation we did was a rather remarkable change that the students really appreciated. The use of that building has risen more than 60% this year after we finished our renovations. So we're really pleased with that, and we were able to add a large number of additional seats there. That space is open till 3 a.m. every morning unless it's finals or midterms, when it's open 24 hours a day. So it's very heavily used. For those of you who are familiar with Langston Library, when you came in, you might have noticed to your right, the south side of the building, we've done some work there. We took out a wall. We added more furniture, new furniture. We recarpeted and reconfigured the space to add more seating. It's created a very dynamic, active space. We've opened it up both in the sense of feeling and the views through the floor, through the very beautiful floor-to-ceiling windows we have overlooking the park. The students are really taking advantage of that space and are enjoying it very much. This summer, we're going to do another phase in Gateway to open up some additional space and create group study rooms, which are very much in demand. So many things with space to accommodate the more than 2.2 million visits we have to library buildings every year. We also take very seriously the cultural role we play in the community, and we put a high priority on our programs for the community, including our exhibits, our popular speaker series, and special events. One of note was the recent Literary Orange, which was a great success. It was a sellout event with over 320 community members coming to campus for this celebration of writing and reading with keynote speakers, writers' panels, book sales and signings, and was very successful. Next year's Literary Orange will be held on campus on Saturday, April 10th, so I hope that you can arrange to join us for that event. Tonight we're opening the library's spring exhibition, Shanghai's Two Faces, Cosmopolitanism and Globalization, which highlights both the local and global influences that have shaped Shanghai's transformation from a fishing and market town into a world-class business, finance, and cultural center. The changes in Shanghai have been remarkable, certainly in less than a lifetime. I was in Shanghai in 1996 giving a paper at a conference. I was talking to a colleague from Hong Kong who frequently traveled from Hong Kong to Shanghai and Beijing, and I was remarking how striking the contrast was, not just from areas of the traditional buildings and area of new buildings, but new buildings being built right next to the traditional buildings in a very stark contrast. And he said, yes, he hardly recognized the skyline since the last time he was there. And I said, well, when were you here last? He said, oh, about 5 weeks ago. I think those physical changes have certainly continued and are only a small part of the transformation of Shanghai. Shanghai has also increasingly become the subject of important scholarly research, and a number of UCI faculty, including our speaker tonight, are making significant contributions to our understanding of the evolution of this dynamic city. The exhibit includes some of their works and highlights the library's research collections on this fascinating area. The library's collections on Shanghai are sizable and include diverse materials in languages and formats, and include subjects such as history, literature, film and media, business, economics, sociology, and architecture. Most of the materials in the exhibit are from our collections here in Langston Library, but a few were on generous loan from UCI faculty and librarians. I want to give a special recognition and thanks to the curator of the exhibit, Ying Zhang. Dr. Zhang is our research librarian for Asian studies and a former college teacher in Shanghai. I think the quality of the exhibit speaks highly of the excellence of her work and her expertise in this topic. So Ying, where are you? I saw you earlier. Ying, there she is. Thank you very much. I know it was quite a demand to do such an excellent exhibit at the same time you were keeping up with all your other duties, so thank you. Our speaker tonight is Jeffrey Wasserstrom. Dr. Wasserstrom is an expert on contemporary social, cultural, and political issues related to China, and has regularly traveled to and taught and written about the country for more than 20 years. His books include Student Protests in 20th Century China, The View from Shanghai, China's Brave New World, and Other Tales for Global Times, and most recently, Global Shanghai 1850 to 2010, A History in Fragments, which compares and contrasts two eras when the city was dramatically transformed, largely because of international flows of people, ideas, products, and capital. Jeff writes regularly for China Bee, an international blog concerning China culture that is based here at UCI. And he's also contributed to Newsweek, the LA Times, The Nation, and the Asian edition of the Wall Street Journal, among many others. He's been a guest on NPR's Morning Edition and has been interviewed by BBC Radio and Australian Television. His talk is entitled, is it up there? Imagining Shanghai Representations of a Cosmopolitan City. We're very pleased to have him with us. Yeah?
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be able to give this talk here. The last time I gave a talk on Shanghai, the last two talks I gave, one was in Shanghai itself, inside one of the buildings that you'll be seeing pictures of along the Bund. And I thought it was a real challenge then to try to talk about the city while people could look out the window and see the images that I was describing. But now there's a sort of similar challenge because this is such a wonderful exhibit and I really was very impressed. I just saw it for the first time like many of you. So here's a challenge to have those images in your mind and try to provide some kind of context for it. It's also a pleasure to be able to be here in California. I've been here for just the last 3 years, though for me it was a homecoming because I grew up in Southern California. But it's great to be on a campus where, after having been in the middle of the country, where China feels closer in many ways, and many more people feel that it's not out of their regular experience to be thinking about China and going to China. And that, I think, gives a special resonance to giving a talk like this and having several faculty members here. I see Wang Feng there, for example, who have done research in Shanghai or written about it. And in the exhibit, we flag Akbar Abbas, who's on the faculty here, has written about the city. And Mei Zhan and so on. So it's exciting, and Roberta Wei in art history. So it's great to have colleagues to talk about, as well as the colleagues who work on other parts of Chinese studies and other parts of history. But now I'll get into my effort to give you a framework to be thinking about as you look at the exhibit, either for the first time or the second. And I want to use as a way into this a series of myths about the city or urban myths, things that are partially true and partially false. Because I think that often the best way to understand a city is to first look at the things that are most widely believed about it. And the most revealing are often the things that are partially true. I think this is true of many cities, especially cities that get heavily represented. Shanghai is one of those in which images of it circulate around the world. Los Angeles is another one, another reason why giving a talk like this in Southern California is particularly relevant. One of my favorite sayings about cities that helps me think about Shanghai is something that the architect and urban critic Michael Sorkin said about Los Angeles, which was that it had been represented through so many media that it had become, quote, virtually unviewable save through the fictive scrim of its mythologizers. So the way to begin is with the myths and then to get underneath them. But the first two images, although this suggests Shanghai like LA is partly so mythologized via film, there are two periods I'll be talking about a lot. One is the Treaty Port period, when Shanghai was a subdivided city, which you'll be hearing about, 1843 to 1943. The other is a period that's sometimes called New Shanghai of the 1990s through the present. Though I'll also be saying there are reasons to keep in mind other periods of Shanghai's past. Those are the ones that are going to, those are the ones that have been most intensely mythologized and represented and shown in films and so forth. So you'll be hearing a lot about them. So, but I want to preface what I'm going to say because of the title of the exhibit about that mentions this term glocalization, which refers to the way in which, even in a period of the global flows and globalization, the local remains important. And this is important to me when I think about Shanghai, because in many ways, in the mid-1980s, when I first went there, there were all sorts of things that were reminding me that I was in China, a particular nation. But there wasn't as much beyond architecture that was reminding me that I was in Shanghai, a place with a very distinctive history. Shanghai's history was folded intently into a national narrative in the 1980s. Since the 1980s, we've heard a lot about the rise, resurgence of Chinese nationalism, and we've heard a lot about China being globalized, being brought into a process of globalization. But when I go to Shanghai, I'm also keenly aware of how much the local has been increasingly important in that. When I go to Shanghai now, even though there are things that let me know I'm in China, insistently they're letting me know that I'm in a very distinctive kind of city. And despite the flow of globalization and nationalism, this is something that's very extreme. Now, this image here is an image that you would, a collage of images that would come to mind when you think about globalization. And if you're in the Thomas Friedman side of things, which I'm not, you think about the flattening of the world and the homogenization of the interchangeability of places in the world through globalization. This would be a shot that I think, you know, for that kind of argument would work well. You see Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. There are those in London. There are those in other places. You see KFC. You see Coca-Cola. You see Starbucks. You see Haagen-Dazs. None of these things, obviously, were in Shanghai in the mid-1980s, so you could get a Coca-Cola. None of the others were there, but now they're all there. So one story would be, this is Shanghai becoming a global city that's somehow partly interchangeable with other places. But if you look more closely at some of those things, the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum is one wax museum in Shanghai, but a more important one that's recently come is this one in the base of the Pearl of the Orient syringe-looking building of one of the new skyscrapers. This is in the basement of that is a wax museum devoted to the history of Shanghai. That's reminding you of the things that are very distinctive about Shanghai's past that's not true of other, necessarily all other Chinese cities. So this would be the local reasserting itself much more, or in addition to the global. The Starbucks insignia you saw, this is one of the places where a Starbucks shows up. If you can see it in one of the photographs there, it's just buried almost, because what's being celebrated in this place surrounding the Starbucks is the 90th anniversary of one of Shanghai's first department stores. And celebrating that in this sort of reminding you that this is a city that had an earlier phase of enmeshment in global consumer trends. You see a rickshaw being put up there and a tram and so forth. To remind you, you're someplace very distinctive. You're not just drinking an interchangeable cup of coffee. The coffee may be interchangeable, but the place isn't. And this is me posing with near one of the most famous dolls in the world, perhaps the most famous, Barbie. This is the latest sign of China's enmeshment and Shanghai's enmeshment in global capital. Barbie has come to Shanghai, with a vengeance. Disney may not be there yet, but it has the first Barbie theme store in the world. And so this was my most recent investigative work, was to go there the last time I was in China. So this would be another sign of Shanghai being kind of interchangeable or being forced into this global pattern. But there's a more famous doll that I also posed by. This is the Haibao, which is the mascot of the World Expo, a sort of World's Fair, the first ever in China, that's coming to Shanghai in 2010. And this is something you'll only see in Shanghai. This is, thank goodness, actually. It's quite bizarre. There's an exhibit of them, and I brought a little show and tell that anyone I can pass around later. But this is something telling you you're someplace specific. And the Hai in the character Haibao is the Hai for the sea. That's the same that Shanghai has in its name. It's the color blue, which is associated in Chinese political color symbolism with openness to the world, the sea flowing outward. So Shanghai is saying, this is its equivalent to the Olympics, but it's putting a particular focus on it that links to its distinctive location and distinctive tie as a gateway to the world. Here you saw some of the images that showed up of international capitalism, KFC, McDonald's. But if you'll see, if you look closer, these are uses of KFC and portrayals of Ronald McDonald that tell you you're someplace quite distinctive. So there's a kind of assertion of the local within the rise of global capitalism. So I subscribe to the Pico Iyer as opposed to Thomas Friedman view of globalization, which is that what's very interesting is the way that these symbols and products and ideas that are going around the world take on locally specific meanings as they make this transition. And the world is still, in many ways, for better and for worse, bumpy as anything. But back to representations of Shanghai, this is a set of images of the myth-making, all of which are about Shanghai's treaty port period, or they're either made during that period or set there. I also like to show this slide because it both suggests the fun of doing research on a city like Shanghai in an era when historians can care about popular culture and representation as well as the hard economic facts and so forth. And so, you know, it's great fun. I can say it's part of my job to watch these movies. But I also want you to know it's actually one of the hardest parts of my job was to sit through the entire Sean Penn Madonna vehicle, Shanghai Surprise, which is not only one of the worst movies I've seen about Shanghai, but one of the worst movies I've seen. Okay, so a set of myths and the stories behind the myths. The most frequently repeated myth about Shanghai is that it was a mere fishing village until the Opium War. And after the Opium War, it almost overnight became one of the world's great metropolises. This was something that was said insistently in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and is still is something you'll come across in a surprising number of guidebooks and journalistic accounts as well. It captures something important about Shanghai, as I'll try to say, but it's utterly false in the sense that Shanghai was not a mere fishing village before the Opium War of the 1830s. In fact, it was a bustling market town with ties to the outside world via trade, just not trade with the West. And that was one reason why the Westerners wanted so badly to get a foothold there. This is a map of Shanghai from early in the 1800s. And the thing that defines a Chinese city, the term for city in Chinese is chengshi, which means basically wall and market. Well, Shanghai had a wall and it sure had a market. And the buildings inside it included academies, temples, and so forth. It was not, in other words, someplace where everybody was fishing. And it was not a village. It had a couple of hundred thousand people. And I don't know any villages of a couple hundred thousand people. So it strains credulity to think of it in any way as being that. In fact, it had been an administrative center of some importance from the 13th century on. So for a Chinese city, it was a very young city, but it was still older than any of the cities that are in the United States. So here's a bit of just background of it. China, and this is a map of the different treaty ports. After the Opium War, and this won't be on the quiz, but after the Opium War, when Westerners before that had been confined to trading via Canton, one of the cities down near the bottom of the map, and Macau, which doesn't quite show up, The Westerners were very frustrated by not having access to other parts of China, so they insisted, after they showed their military superiority in beating the Qing dynasty in order to protect their drug trade, was to claim that they would have to have parts of several different Chinese cities up the coast in which they would be able to sort of run things their own way, would be governed by their own laws, and trade would go on in the way that they'd been accustomed to, rather than the way that the Chinese government, the Qing dynasty, was trying to control trade. And one of the places they chose was Shanghai, which you'll see about halfway up the coast there. And they got several other cities that were between Canton and there. So if you look at this larger map of China and you locate Shanghai about halfway up on the coast, you can see why strategically it would be a very significant spot to have. It's right on the at the mouth of the Yangtze River. The Yangtze River connects China's most fertile inland provinces, the ones by the cities of Chongqing and Chengdu, Sichuan province, and others, between that middle of the country and the sea. It was a key spot for the Westerners to want to get because of the trade via the Yangtze. It was already a city that was very involved with international trade and it had a bustling harbor. This was why the British really wanted it to be one of the ports, unlike Hong Kong that they had to kind of take because, well, they didn't particularly want it, but they got it. Shanghai they really wanted. An early visitor had described the harbor as being a wilderness of masts. There were ships from all ships there. They weren't ships that were trading with the West, but they were ships that were trading with Southeast Asia. So Shanghai was already an administrative center, a market town of some significance, and an international harbor, to the extent we can think about it, connecting the Qing Empire to markets down in Southeast Asia. So it was clearly someplace that they wanted. So it gets it wrong in multiple ways to think of it as a mere village. Now, one of the questions is, so I'll get to why I showed this image now. Why has this myth of the fishing village turned instantly into a great city persisted so long? And I think there are several reasons. Another version of it would say that Shanghai, before the Westerners came, was just a wilderness of marshes, a city of reeds. Now, the reason for that this had some kind of valence was that the part of the city that was given to the Westerners to settle and set up their own place in, just to the north of the old walled city, was reclaimed land, a mud flat, nothing but marshes. And in a short period of time, the Westerners did build it into something that looked much more like a city. So there was some basis to that. If you just read the Chinese part of the city that continued to exist out of the picture, you could say this piece of land that is now part of a great city was not so long ago not developed land. So that was one thing. Westerners also liked the story because it made them look very good. They came, were given, had nothing. They turned a place that was nothing into something that was great. But why has the you can even hear this some version of this fishing village to great metropolis sort of reborn at times even in Chinese works. And one of these is that this vision of Shanghai as a place capable of these magical transformations. One Western text in the 1890s said, since we've been here in these last 50 years, it's grown as by enchantment. This idea of some sort of magical thing is partly because in the second period of Shanghai's most dramatic transformation, the last 20 years, again, a piece of land that was largely undeveloped, Pudong or East Shanghai, has suddenly gone from being a fairly undeveloped spot to being an incredibly modern looking one, which these buildings, there were no tall buildings on the side of the river that these stand in when I first lived there in 1986. So I think in a certain way, this notion of Shanghai as a place distinctively capable of undergoing these magical transformations is something that's gotten a new lease on life with this second transformation in Pudong. This is looking up what used to be the tallest building in Shanghai. But when I went up to the 88th floor and looked out the window, I caught the eye of construction workers who were being taken up to build the bigger building going up next door. So what you have is these two kinds of visions of Shanghai's transformation, which are often shown now in juxtapositions of one another. The buildings in the front foreground of this is a model that you walk into the Urban Planning Museum and you see this. You see the buildings that used to represent the tallest buildings in Shanghai near the foreground. And in the background, you see the tall buildings that have gone up in Pudong during this second from nothing to something move. And this continual juxtaposition of it the idea being that, yes, Shanghai went through this amazing transformation when the Westerners were under control. But now, look at the even grander transformations gone under now that we're under control, the Chinese. I think of this as nationalist revenge via architecture. And there's a continual set of juxtapositions of these. Okay, this is the second myth. The notion that Shanghai was a, quote, colonial city from the 1840s to the 1940s, which is, again, something you'll hear mentioned very casually in tour books and stuff like that. And they'll talk about, well, there was that colonial period. And the problem with that is that, at least from my understanding of a colony, is that there's a clear metropole, or you're part of an empire. A colonial city is something, and we know this from the American past, the colonies, it's usually separated by a body of water from a place that controls things. So that if you're a colonial city in Philadelphia, when it was a colonial city, the people in charge of Philadelphia had to answer to people appointed in, or in some way answer to London. And if you have Saigon as a colonial city of the French, the high official was appointed by Paris. Shanghai was not that kind of colony. Hong Kong was. Shanghai was rather a divided city in which, on this you can kind of make out the walled city by the river, and then there were some things above it. But actually, first the British got a piece of it, then the Americans did, then the British and the Americans joined together and formed what you see on this map as the International Settlement, which was kind of which was not a colonial city in any, or even city within a city. It was run by a locally elected municipal council, which was not an egalitarian one, not a purely democratic one, because the only people who could vote or stand for office, at least until the 1920s, were male taxpayers who were not Chinese. But it was locally run. It wasn't directly, it was dominated by British and American business interests, and then later also Japanese. But it wasn't, the official that ran it didn't answer to any one foreign nation or one foreign empire. The French decided, in maybe typically French fashion, not to join with the British and Americans to make sort of one big international settlement, but instead kept their own French concession. Which really, one of the big differences wasn't just French cussedness, but was the fact that the French were largely Catholic. I mean, there was a large missionary tie. The British and Americans were largely Protestant. So it was partly fissured along those lines, as well as others, and colonial competition between Britain and France. The French concession was a kind of colonial setup with a high official who answered to Paris and so forth. So you could say that Shanghai had a colonial, was made up of three cities within a city, one of which was a colonial city, one of which was sort of like a city-state, and the other of which, the surrounding white area and all of this, was still under Chinese control. So there was always a time during the treaty port period, except for a brief period when Japan invaded, and briefly, if there was a period when Shanghai became a colonial city in the sort of proper sense, it was from 1941 to 1945 when the Japanese controlled all of it. From 1937, the Japanese invaded all of the white areas you see there, which were Chinese controlled, but the French concession and the international settlement stayed untouched until 1941, right after Pearl Harbor, when the Japanese knew the Americans were coming to the war anyway. They went for broke and invaded the international settlement, which is the scenes you see so memorably portrayed in Empire of the Sun, one of Steven Spielberg's two Shanghai movies. And if you want to ask what the other one was, you'll have to wait till the question and answer. Third, and this I'll have to rein myself in because I've co-authored an entire article about this legendary sign. There were two of us who were working on this, one in Britain and one in me in the US, and the advisor of the guy in Britain heard me give a talk about it and said, you know, I've got a student working on this and there's not going to be room for two articles about this. So we decided to collaborate. But frequently repeated in guidebooks, in newspaper stories, and still defended as utter truth by many Chinese you meet in Shanghai, is the idea that there used to be a sign for decades outside of the best park in Shanghai saying no dogs or Chinese allowed. In fact, there was no such sign with that precise wording. And when we say this, we wrote this article and we said that that's no sign with that exact wording stood for decades outside of the park. When we published our article, there was a special session to criticize it held by the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences to talk about what a terrible thing it was that we had written that. We also said in our piece, but the prejudice that it was said to exist certainly did exist. And then we got annoyed letters written from former Shanghai Landers, Westerners in the city, who had been saying, for years we've been denying that that sign existed because we weren't racist. And we sort of said, well, the sign didn't exist, but you were racist. So we managed to offend both sides, which I think is the sign usually of good scholarship. So this is the part. Just very briefly, there were rules saying this park is only for the use of foreign residents and Chinese servants. And in fact, the main users of the park at many points were Chinese amas with Western kids. So the idea that there were no Chinese allowed was not only not factual to the park regulations, but also distorts the fact that it was largely used by Chinese. The other thing that's left out of it that makes it a more interesting story, I think, to figure out how Shanghai worked, was that for a long time, there were elite Chinese who said, we understand why you want to keep the coolies out, but we're civilized and respectable people, why can't we use it? So they were sort of arguing, let our class trump our race or nationality. And they got quite annoyed. They said, we understand if you want a whites-only park, actually, but you let the Koreans and the Japanese and even the Indians, who we all know are slaves of the British, use this park, and yet we can't on the same basis, unless you let the lowliest of us in as servants. So there was this very complicated thing about the dynamics of hierarchies in the city that I think you learn by looking at something like the park. And very cleverly, some of the elite Chinese who played to American sensibilities, because Americans were partly running the park, said, you know, aren't you the people who have make a big deal about taxation without representation being a very bad thing? Well, we're the people who pay taxes that help run this park, and we can't sit on the official body that decides how the park rules work. Doesn't that sound like the kind of thing you've taught us when we've studied in America and for colleges, not what you believe in? And it eventually, long story short, eventually they did manage to get this through. And something was changed so that Chinese were allowed in the park. There were no discrimination based on nationality. It happened after white Russian refugees started pouring into the city in the 1920s. And the elite Chinese said, again, look, you're even letting Russian beggars into the park, and we can't. So they said, yeah, we understand your thing. And so a use fee was introduced that made the park off limits to all but the economic elite of all races and nationalities in the park. So in the Chinese, this became an important patriotic legend, though, that this sign with this wording had existed. So they would show this photograph to prove it in books published in China. But of course, I mean, it's a very fuzzy picture. This isn't just my fuzziness. And the regulations don't say that. It says something about foreigners and Chinese servants, and then a totally different thing. There's about dogs. In some signs, there's no dogs or bicycles allowed. In some, very complicatedly, they say Japanese are allowed to use the park, but only if they dress in Western clothing.